Well, hey there, and happy Earth Day 2016. Earth Week, Earth Month, Earth Day every day, right? Right. That's kind of how I feel about it. I'm not going to screw around with poetry and all kinds of cool stuff. I'm going to ask you to go to thegreendivas.com and check out some of our latest stories. We do have a fun Earth Day piece and a new 1 GD minute video tutorial on how to make safe, non-toxic foaming hand soap, which is like so much cheaper than the other stuff. It's a very full show, really great stuff. Meanwhile, I'm hoping to see you out there in social media land. Green Diva Meg, at Green Diva Meg on Twitter and Instagram. The Green Divas, at The Green Divas Twitter and Instagram and Facebook, of course. So stay tuned and rock out your Earth Day.
Every Green Diva needs a sidekick. At The Green Divas radio show, they're called Green Dudes. Time now for a deeper shade of green from a guy's perspective.
Well, I talked to these guys a couple of years ago, these very creative guys. The one we're talking to today is Dave Room, who's the producer of Pacha's Pajamas. It's a really wonderful, creative children's story series. And it's a book, it's an animated book, and there's all kinds of cool things and new things about this that you're going to learn about. But it's been a couple of years, and when I first spoke to the author and co-creator Aaron Abelman a couple of years ago, it was a book. And it has blossomed into this whole wonderful digital sort of integrated storytelling thing that the theme is all very positive for kids around the globe. And Pacha's Pajamas tells stories about the earth, environmental issues and social issues, and all in a positive way. So anyway, hi, Dave. How are you?
I'm good, Megan. How are you?
Well, I had that like long-winded intro there, but you know, I'm trying to describe because I'm so impressed. And I know when we spoke a couple of years ago, I had interviewed Aaron, and you and I had not really spoken too much, but we'd corresponded, of course. And I mean, wow, what has happened in 2 years? Here, please give us a description of Pacha's Pajamas and what's going on.
Yeah, well, Pacha's Pajamas is a children's environmental awakening story that's about a little girl and her journey to learn more about herself and her connection with the natural world. It's essentially taking this template that we've developed that we think is really powerful, and that is when this little girl, Pacha, goes to sleep, whatever's on her PJs comes alive in her dreams, and the characters guide her on a dream journey to learn more about herself and the topic of the dream world. And in the first case, it's nature. So there's plants and animals on her PJs. She goes to sleep, and she comes to this this clearing in the jungle, and there's all these different animals and plants that are complaining about the state of their home, and they don't know what to do. So they decide, after a lot of argumentation and people trying to figure out how to get their needs met, they decide to all come together and throw this huge festival in the jungle. We've taken this story and created not only a book, but as you mentioned, it's an animated book, which means there's an app and you put it over the illustrations in the book, and it brings them to life with really short videos that help increase story comprehension and expressive vocabulary. So that's kind of where we're at now.
It's so fun. And I was watching one with a little platypus that was dancing. And yeah, it's very clever. And the way that you've integrated everything is very, well, it offers a variety of compelling storytelling platforms, really.
Yeah, and what we've found is that there are different kids that learn different ways.
Yeah.
And also, when you bring in multimedia, you have the opportunity to have something that's much more immersive. And as I was mentioning, the literature says that augmented reality used in the way that we are actually improves story comprehension and expressive vocabulary. So we've got this great story that has all these embedded messages about we are all connected. We have everything we need within ourselves. We can create the world we want to live in. So we want kids to really get it.
Well, I got it. So that's a good sign.
So, absolutely.
Dave, you're also referred to quite often as Malia's papa. And I know she was part of your inspiration for being involved in this project, but maybe you want to tell us what that means.
Well, when my daughter was about 2 weeks old, she's 13 years old now.
Wow.
When she was 2 weeks old, her mother put her on my chest and she just inched up into my neck, in the crook of my neck. And it felt like a little puppy, like the sweetest little puppy. And this feeling went all the way through my entire body. And I knew at that moment that this was the most important relationship in my life.
Yeah.
And a week later, it came to me that I need to be able to look her in the eyes when she's a young adult and tell her that I did everything I possibly could to make this a better place.
Heavy sigh, you know, and you are. I mean, I think it's marvelous. And I think most of us will agree that who've had children, that experience of that importance of that relationship and suddenly this responsibility that, you know, whatever we're doing in the world is going to have an impact on them for much longer range than just our lives. So it's an important moment. And I'm not sure everybody, I think everybody does what they can in their way, but it's kind of cool that you're taking it into a realm and really sharing it with everybody's children.
Yeah. And it's funny, it didn't start out that way. I mean, I really jumped into this research project, my own personal research project, to just understand what's going on in the world. And I had a little bit of a sense, but I didn't realize the extent to it. And I ended up getting into the whole thing around oil. And then I got into resiliency and how we can build up our communities. And it came to me that I needed to start integrating entertainment, music, and story if I wanted to reach the masses, reach more people of color, more young people, more mainstream thinkers. And, and then as I started incorporating more story into what I was doing, I realized, you know what? I want to work with kids because it's really highly leveraged. I mean, the kids are going to be the leaders of the future, the teachers of the future, the parents of the future. And there are some parents that probably right now the only way to get through to them is through their kids. Yeah. So I just thought that it would be great to work with kids.
Well, I think it's, it's a great idea in many ways. Now, you know, your work is award-winning and you have some really cool, high-profile folks working with you, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And in terms of the album and the voiceovers for the videos,
you
have Mos Def, Cheech Marin, Talib Kweli, and a bunch of amazing kids. I want to get a shout out to. There's 30 kids on the album.
Wow.
We're really excited about that.
Wow. Yeah, that is exciting. So you just recently launched which? The animated book?
Yeah, so it's the animated book and the app. It's both iPhone and Android compatible apps, and the apps display music and videos that are from the album. So you end up getting these amazing, really short, ranging from, you know, 3 or 4 seconds to a couple minute videos that help the child understand better what's going on in the story and gives them just a richer palette of emotions that are associated with the moment that they're looking at in the book.
Oh, I'd imagine that they would think it was so cool. Like, oh my gosh, look, it's coming to life. Yay.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, what we're really interested in is to see how kids use it. And we're hoping that they don't just like go through the whole book looking for the videos without reading the story.
Yeah, they might. But now, what is the age range sweet spot for this book?
The book is written for 7 to 12-year-olds. So we're thinking kind of highly advanced reader 7-year-olds and 12-year-olds who may not necessarily be reading the thickest young adult fiction yet at that point.
Right.
I know my daughter, she would probably read this book at 9 or 10.
Yep.
But definitely there's a lot of 12-year-olds that are reading it and getting a lot out of it. And we think it can be really powerful in the school context as well to really start some conversations and get kids interested in plants, animals, and nature.
Well, then you could start, I'm sure, a little earlier than if you have a teacher guiding or whatever. So I'm asking selfishly because I have grandchildren, a 4.5-year-old and a 6-year-old. My granddaughter's 4.5 and my grandson's 6, and he's very precocious, 6. So I'm kind of thinking like maybe I could, you know, read with them and do this with them. They might enjoy it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, some of my fondest memories are my dad sitting down with me and my brother and sisters. And we had a difference of about 5 years. I'm 5 years older than my brother and my sisters in between us. And yeah, I mean, I think at the different ages and comprehension levels, kids get different things, but the 4-year-old will certainly enjoy being read to them. And the 6-year-old, probably, depending on how advanced he is, he may be able to read a little bit of himself, but I'm sure he would also really enjoy being read to or being helped through the reading process with book.
Oh, yeah. So tell us how we can find the book.
Well, the book is available on many online retailers, including Amazon.com, Barnes & Noble, and the whole plethora of digital retailers has it. And you can also check out our website, PachasPajamas.com. We've got not only the book available, but there's a bunch of videos and other things about the philosophy behind the project.
Well, I'm thinking this is just a great way to celebrate Earth Day, Earth Month, every day. But this happens to be this particular segment will go out right around Earth Day. So I'm just saying, you know, it's a great way to get with the kids and keep the message moving. Thanks so much for all this exciting work, Dave. And I'm looking forward to getting my hands on the new book.
Oh, Megan, thank you so much for the work that you're doing, shining a light on different projects and things that may not necessarily get the mainstream attention at the moment, but it's really important that they get some light. So thank you so much.
Hey, it's my pleasure. All right, folks, stay tuned.
Want more information on this Green Dude segment and other ideas for low-stress green living? Go to thegreendivas.com. That's greendivas.com. The Green Divas love food. Organic, local, fresh, whole, delicious food. Here now is another Green Diva foodie file.
As always, I do look forward to all the work EWG, Environmental Working Group, for those of you that don't know. They do so much homework for us and make things so much easier in understanding what's out there, what's healthy, what's toxic, products that we should be looking out for, ingredients that we should be watching. And every year they do their Dirty Dozen and the Clean 15. It's been going on for quite a few years. And, you know, it's funny. In my mind, I saw peaches at the top of the list a few years ago, and that's it. They're at the top of the list forever. And I forget that every year there's new data, whatever, there are new studies, and they review everything. So this year I got a press release in my inbox or whatever newsletter from them, and it was all about strawberries hitting the top of the list. And I thought, oh no, oh no. So I'm really glad that today we have Sonia Lunder, who is a senior analyst with EWG, again, Environmental Working Group, to tell us about what's going on with strawberries and other things on the list. Hi, Sonia.
Hello.
So yeah, I was really sad. And when I was just reading about it before we got talking before you called, There's something about soil for strawberries being injected with nerve gas. What the heck? What does that mean?
Yeah, unfortunately, strawberries are very vulnerable to pests, and as a result, conventional strawberries are grown in fields where they inject pesticide gases into the soil, cover them with plastic tarps, and really sterilize by killing all the soil microbes before they transplant in the strawberry plants and grow them to harvest. So there's an incredibly intense use of these fumigant pesticides on strawberries.
The whole concept is so disturbing. It makes me really never want to eat. And I have for years not. I've tried to avoid non-organic strawberries. I didn't know the extent of, but I do know that they are vulnerable. So they are kind of, you know, heavily laden with pesticides and things. But, you know, you and I also chatted a bit about there have been some reports about organic strawberries in the store that are labeled organic sometimes are not completely organic. And you explained it well. So would you explain it again?
Yes, this issue has been raised over the course of the last couple of years, but the organic rules grant an exemption when organic seeds and starts are not available. And in the case of strawberries, a lot of strawberries that are sold and raised and marketed as organic actually got their birth in a nursery where there were strawberries, pesticides used on the starter plants. Strawberries are always transplanted from one location into the fields where they'll grow and create fruit. And so there's some chance that the organic strawberries that you're purchasing were treated with pesticides before, you know, in the baby stage before they were transplanted into the fields. But this is something that the industry is investing in solving by growing and creating nurseries where they can grow organic seedlings for transplant.
Well, that's encouraging. And in my mind, as we were talking initially about this nerve gas thing and how vulnerable they are, whatever gas, I'm thinking, can we just build some really nice, you know, greenhouse, giant greenhouses for strawberries where they might not be so vulnerable and they don't need to be gassed?
Well, I think that it's really important to highlight here that organic farmers are innovating and using ancient technologies like crop rotation and modern technologies that are much more like building up the soil with the organic layer or compost to avoid using fumigants on the farm fields. And this is a crop that when it's grown conventionally is really heavily treated with pesticides. We found about 300 pounds of pesticides applied per acre, and a lot of those are those soil-killing fumigants, and it really highlights the tenacity and innovation in the organic industry that they're able to create and widely sell organic strawberries that don't have to have those poisonous gases.
Well, I'm so glad because, you know, a green diva needs her strawberries in the spring, in the summer, you know, come on. But, you know, the work that you do with this, are there any other surprises or really anything notable that's changed this year in these reports?
Well, we look at pesticide residues on fruits, conventionally grown fruits and vegetables every year using a massive data set developed by the U.S. Department of Agriculture. And we do find consistent differences between crops. Our Dirty Dozen remain fairly stable over the years, although there's some shifting around in the list. And this year, strawberries rose to the top, even though those fumigants that are so heavily used on strawberries dissipate into the atmosphere and don't necessarily remain as residues on the strawberries. We did find a lot of pesticides. About 40% of the strawberry samples in this year's testing had 10 or more pesticides on them. That's after they're washed by the producer, they're sent to the store, you bring them home and wash them. These are really trying to mimic the types of fruit that you would actually be eating.
Right.
Yeah, strawberries, even in that situation, had lots of pesticide residues on them. Apples have been the number one crop on the Dirty Dozen list for several years, and we see slightly fewer pesticide residues on apples.
Well, that's encouraging.
Yeah, some changes on the list. But generally, a lot of tree fruits, nectarines and peaches, cherries, and then celery, spinach and tomatoes are these kind of common fruits that and vegetables that have a lot of pesticide residues on them when you buy them in the store.
Wow. Well, you know, so there's always a case for growing your own, then you know for sure. But I am encouraged because I don't know how long, y'all have been doing these lists and this research, but I've got to believe, based on what I remember from statistics recently, that organic farming is growing. And like you said, there's a lot of innovators out there in the organic growing field, farmers. So have you seen over the years, you know, some changes that have occurred because there is more organic innovation?
We don't think organic is nearly large enough. We know that
I agree with that.
A supply issue. Costco recently said that it would love to buy and sell a lot more organic produce, but they're not able to. We know that the subsidy system in the U.S. is heavily tilted toward producing commodities.
Don't even get me started on that stupid farm bill.
And we'd like to see a real promotion of growing healthy and ecologically sound fruits and vegetables for Americans to consume. We'd like to see that subsidized by the federal government.
Yeah.
And we'd like to see people being able to afford and purchase and enjoy these organic fruits and vegetables.
Well, but has there been an increase over the last few years from, I mean, I know it's not enough. I know it's not enough yet and that we're getting there. But, I mean, has there been? Okay.
Organic is definitely increasing year after year, and we're impatient and hoping that it continues to grow as quickly as possible, especially with this information about pesticides being really abundant on conventionally grown fruits and vegetables. You know, more than half and up to three quarters of conventional foods have pesticide residues on them. We do see some foods that just based on their properties or where they're grown, have few pesticide residues on them. But even then, there's stuff used during the production. And so, you know, we want to see a shift, and we are glad to see the numbers increasing. But we know that there's a consumer demand and hope to see a positive trend in the organic sector.
Well, I mean, hearing that Costco would like to sell more organic and that it just isn't available is encouraging. And that if someone's thinking about, I might start an organic farm, and you're listening, do it. We need you. And I'm sure there are more and more, farmer cooperatives that are trying to meet the demand for organic, produce. Thank you. Yay. Because I can't grow my own. I mean, I grow some things, but no. Between the deer and my squirrels, I fight with them on my deck, so... I'm really glad that I have farmers that are, doing it for me. Yay.
Agreed.
So any last words about this year that stand out about this year's report before we close up?
Well, people can see the whole food list by going to ewg.org/foodnews, and we show the results of pesticide testing for about 50 different fruits and vegetables. You can see those things that you like and buy and give you a little nudge to buy organic versions of those things that you buy and eat a lot that are on the Dirty Dozen list.
Yeah, and I mean, I already buy organic, but I'll tell you, it was a little bit scary when you see statistics like there's something like 60 different types of pesticides used to grow in different combinations to grow strawberries alone. And then when you start to read what some of these things that are commonly used, they're carcinogens, they're hormone disruptors, they're killing the soil, they're killing bees, whatever. It's bad. It's just bad.
Yeah, agreed. And that's why we do this guide.
Yay. Well, thank you so much for the work you're doing and for coming on and talking to us today about it. And I look forward to talking to you again maybe before next year.
Great. Thank you so much for having me.
Hope you're hungry. For more easy and delicious recipes and even more foodie information, go to thegreendivas.com. That's greendivas.com.
Care about the environment and social justice? Stay tuned as Green Divas and Green Dudes from Greenpeace, those folks on the front lines of environmental activism, report on the hottest eco issues and ways you can take action. All right. Well, this is our Greenpeace Green Diva today. Eva Resnick-Day, She's a democracy organizer for Greenpeace USA. And I think the last segment we did, we talked a little bit about removing fossil fuel from the equation, from the political campaigns. And I think Eva's incident with Hillary Clinton came up in the conversation, so we decided we would talk to her directly. Hi, Eva.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
So, yeah, so there you were on the campaign trail, huh?
Yep.
And you asked a question that I think you mentioned before that others have asked, but tell us what happened.
Yeah, so I was on the rope line at an organizing event in Purchase, New York, with the intention of asking Secretary Clinton about rejecting fossil fuel money in her campaign, which we've asked all candidates to do. And this is by no means the first time that we were asking Clinton the question herself. But I was lucky enough and waited long enough to be in the front of that rope line and ask the question that started, "Thank you so much for tackling climate change. Will you act on those words and reject fossil fuel money in the future in your campaign?" And to be specific, we're talking about money from registered lobbyists of the fossil fuel industry.
Okay.
Yeah. And then so she snapped a little bit. She said, I have not taken money from anyone in the industry except individuals that work for the industry. And I tried to interject and registered lobbyists. And that's when she kind of snapped and said, "I'm so sick of the Sanders campaign spreading lies about me." And I personally do not have any affiliation with the Sanders campaign. So I think that's
like,
why it spread.
And you didn't get an opportunity to set her straight, I'm sure.
No, that was about it. I think you could see in the video, I tried to keep the conversation going, but no one was having that.
Yeah, she was not a happy camper at that point. And I'm sure it wasn't personal. And perhaps she had been something else obviously was happening. But it's a legitimate question. And I think I'm really glad that you all are out there on these rope lines and in the media kind of holding her feet to the fire and holding as many of the candidates as we can. You know, talk about Fixed Democracy, which is, I guess, the campaign that you're really working on.
Yeah, so Greenpeace, in a kind of unprecedented move, has made democracy one of our two main campaigns. And the reason for that is that the way that our government currently works, it is so infused with money from lobbyists, from corporations, from individuals looking for access of candidates for their own agendas, that we haven't been able to move on anything as a country.
Right.
We haven't been able to tackle climate change, even though, you know, we've known that not only is it real and has been caused by humans, but that it's occurring right now and people's lives are at risk right now.
Right.
But we also haven't been able to move on immigration justice or racial justice or economic justice. There's just a whole host of issues that are intrinsically tied together that we will not be able to tackle in a deep or meaningful way until we fix the democracy so that it works for the people and not corporations.
Yeah, right on. It's so true. I'm like, I get all excited because, and it is unprecedented. Greenpeace has traditionally been much more involved directly in environmental and social, you know, causes. So what's interesting to me that is recognizing that it's almost impossible to make change through legal channels or political channels or governmental channels anymore because it's so broken. And Greenpeace is saying, hello, wake up, people. We have to fix this. And boy, am I so on board with that. And tell me how it's going. How is the campaign? I know you've got other organizations that have joined in on this. How is the impact? Do you have any kind of report on that?
Yeah, well, it's one of those things that isn't super tangible to give results to because we're not going to be able to overturn Citizens United or reform the system until folks are in office, and that's a long, arduous process, unfortunately.
Yeah.
But what I can say is that people, hundreds and thousands of citizens from around the country are no longer willing to wait until the ballot box. They're no longer willing to wait to cast their vote, to be demanding justice and demanding answers from candidates on the campaign trail. And so I think that's what's really powerful, is that we have citizens that are taking democracy into their own hands. They're waiting for 5 or 6 hours on the rope line to get an answer about an issue that a candidate hasn't taken a stance on, whether it be Atlantic Drilling, Keystone XL Pipeline, or Black Lives Matter protests saying, hey, you need an answer for saying the word super predator back in the day, and actually getting an answer on the national scale.
Yeah.
And then we're also seeing right now at Democracy Spring and this weekend with Democracy Awakening in D.C., thousands of individuals coming out and putting their bodies on the line and getting arrested, demanding that Congress changes its ways and acts for the people and restores voting rights.
Gosh.
So that's not super tangible, but what is happening with this campaign is that we're talking about the way our democracy works on a national scale. And I don't think that that's happened before. I couldn't believe that we were arguing the intricacies of fossil fuel donations on national television.
Right.
That to me was completely unprecedented. And regardless of the outcome, just the fact that people are noticing that money matters and that our democracy isn't working and needs to be fixed and are standing up to do something about it is new and incredible.
Well, it's brilliant. And Greenpeace traditionally has had a huge impact. I mean, I'm a Greenpeace, what's the word I'm looking at? A fan. I'm a huge fan. And because Greenpeace has been on the front lines making change and rallying citizens around the world, but of course we're talking about the U.S. right now, rallying citizens to stand up to like the Shell No campaign or and having an impact. So while it isn't so tangible in numbers yet or visible change, I think it's exciting to see Greenpeace and all these other organizations that are joining in and saying, like, we've had enough of this. And it really is an exciting thing to see, because, of course, I'm completely on board with really the agenda, all of the agenda that I've learned so far from what I've read about what y'all are doing. And, you know, just asking the candidates to not accept fossil fuel money is huge. And it's a really like and that in Monsanto. I saw my other thing with Hillary is please, you know, let's, you know, take a healthier stance with GMOs and separate from Monsanto, please. So just had to throw that in there. you know, so what, tell me what, and then we're going to have to wrap it up because we're running over, but this is so important. Tell me what the most inspiring and exciting thing you've encountered out there in this process.
The most inspiring thing I've seen is just the fact that regular everyday people that we've identified that just want to get involved in the process, we're able to give them a really short training, and then they go out there in Bird Dog and actually have been able to change the stances of Secretary Clinton on a number of environmental issues just by asking these questions over and over again and getting them on tape where she hasn't taken a stance before. So Bird Doggers got Clinton to be against the Keystone XL pipeline after following her on the New Hampshire Trail for a long time. We also were able to get her to come out against Atlantic Drilling before President Obama did for the first time on video on the campaign trail. Also, my good friend Adam was able to get Clinton to say that it would be a done deal for her to ban fossil fuel extraction on public lands if she were in office.
Whoa.
And that was huge. She kind of stepped back a little bit after that video went out and said, you know, well, once we have the clean energy infrastructure in place. But those things wouldn't be happening, and she wouldn't even be talking about those issues on the campaign trail at all if there weren't everyday citizens that were willing to give a half of their day to stand in line all day and then just ask a direct question of a candidate. And I think that new technology, like having our smartphones and being able to spread this information online, is really bringing the democracy back into the hands of the people.
Right on, sister. I'm with you. Well, yes. I'm really excited about the work you're doing, and I'm ready to jump on one of these rope lines and start, you know, pestering her about GMOs. You know, because you guys got all this other stuff handled really well. So,
thanks.
Anyway, I hope that you'll come back on the show soon and give us an update, because we've got a political season that's going to go on. It seems like forever already, but
yeah, it's a long time till November.
But I'm looking forward to speaking to you again soon as things progress.
Yeah, you as well. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, Eva, one more thing before we go. Tell people how they can get involved.
Absolutely. There's a few ways. So the way that's coming up really soon is this weekend in Washington, D.C., there is an event called Democracy Awakening. And there's going to be thousands of people descending on D.C. For a rally on Sunday, teach-ins on Saturday, and on Monday, hundreds are going to be sitting in on the steps of the Capitol and demanding a Congress that works for the people.
Well,
so that's what it's.
A lot of people may not hear this until after that. So tell us, like, is there a place they can go specific? Is it just the Greenpeace USA site?
Yeah. If you go to the Greenpeace.org website, there is a beautiful orange button that says get involved. And if you click it, it'll bring you to our activism site called Greenwire. And then our folks will get in touch with you and we'll be able to work with you to start a group, run a campaign, or just find small ways to plug you into the work we're doing. And we need everyone if we're going to have a democracy that actually works for the people.
Yeah. All right. Great. Thank you so much. And good luck this weekend in D.C. And we'll talk again soon.
Perfect. Thank you so much.
To get active and connect with other Green Divas and Green Dudes, visit greenpeace.org/USA. And of course, check out thegreendivas.com for more ways to live a deeper shade of green. Green Divas Heart Wildlife. Who can resist all those videos and images of adorable baby animals? But sometimes these adorable creatures really need our help. Let's celebrate wild animals, learn about them, and do what we can to help them.
Very happy to be speaking again to John Platt, who is a freelance environmental journalist extraordinaire. That's me saying that. But he is. And he's doing a wonderful series called, a little scary series actually, Extinction Countdown through Scientific America, which is getting a lot of attention, and rightfully so. Hi, John.
Hi, Meg.
And, you know, I was looking through some of these articles, and I was like, oh, that's sad. Oh, my gosh, what's happening there? And, yeah. So tell us kind of what I mean, it seems obvious, but tell us what prompted you to work on this series.
Well, I've always been interested in endangered species. I think it's part of who I am and where I, you know, the way I grew up. I grew up outside of Buffalo, not that far from Love Canal. When I was growing up, there were the stories of DDT affecting eagles. Gorillas in the Mist was a huge touch point for me, the movie starring Sigourney Weaver.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, all these things came together. And about 10 years ago, I was working as a technology writer, and I kept coming across all these stories about endangered species that I thought weren't really being covered in the broader media. So I said, well, if no one else is doing it, I better do it myself.
Yeah.
And I started this off as something on my own. It was later picked up by a magazine called Plenty when they went out of business. Scientific American picked it up. I've been over there for about 6 years. And I just, I could keep writing about this stuff for decades. There's never a lack of stories.
No, sadly, there's not.
No.
I'm sorry, I'm laughing.
And you know, but the more you dig into it, too, I mean, if you look at the public coverage of endangered species, you hear about the same things over and over again. Basically, it's the polar bear. That's what everyone talks about. But there's so much more.
No, and like you're writing about some amazing, amazing old fish. I mean, old species.
Yeah. And, I just did an article about the coelacanth, which is that classic, famous creature that everyone thought was extinct. It was only existed in the fossil record, and in the 1930s, one popped up in a fishing net.
Yeah.
And now we know that they're out there, but now, once again, they are actually literally, really, truly this time threatened with extinction. So,
you know, and then I saw, like, plants. There's some beautiful purple plant in Hawaii that is endangered.
And it's just been discovered. So there's all these things that we know are endangered. There's a lot of things. There's an awful lot of species out there that we haven't even seen as humans or officially scientifically described. Once we find them, we know, okay, this Hawaiian plant only exists within a couple of hundred square yards, basically.
Wow.
And one little event, and they could be gone.
Well, and then there's that volcano. I mean, if it happens to be anywhere near, is it Kilauea that's going? I can't
know. Yeah, yep.
Well, and have you ever read Douglas Adams?
Oh, of course.
I mean, I'm like such a fan. I'm still mad that he left the planet. But he wrote a wonderful book, which was really kind of out of his normal realm, and it was called Last Chance to See.
Exactly.
And that had to be.
I think that was another book that I read that really influenced the things that I do. And in fact, a lot of people don't realize this, but he did that book and the original BBC radio series with a photographer named Mark Carwardine.
Yes.
And they did a follow-up a couple of years ago that was available as a TV series, another book. Really great stuff.
Yeah, of course, without Douglas Adams.
Yeah.
But it's still important information, and it's just that I happen to be attached to his quirky style.
But, well, how could you not be?
I know. And as I was saying, you know, and this stuff's been going on for a while. This is not new news, because as I was reading your articles and kind of just preparing for this interview, the Joni Mitchell song, Paved Paradise, Put Up a Parking Lot, was racing through my head, you know, farmer, farmer, put away the DDT now. And I'm like, you know what? And she sings Save Me the Birds and the Bees Now. And I'm like, yeah, this has been, and that was in the 70s, right?
Absolutely. You know, this is not a new problem, but at the same time, it's probably a worse problem in a lot of ways. A lot of species face even greater threats than ever before.
Yeah.
But it's also just something we don't talk about enough. It's a tough topic to tackle.
Now, are humans on that list?
Not exactly.
Not exactly. We're too many of us still.
Yeah.
But, you know, I just had to throw that out there. So what in your research, I know you've got a series going. What is the one that really, really stood out to you, maybe as – like it really pulled on your heartstrings, like, oh, no, that's – I mean, I know they all do, but is there one that stands out for you that's more shocking or something?
Well, I think I always go down to rhinos. Rhinos are one of those species or groups of species that I can cover several times a year because there's always something going on. They're truly in crisis. They're being murdered solely for their horns.
Now, see, that is so upsetting.
Which is like being killed for your fingernails.
Yeah, yeah.
And the problem just gets worse and worse and worse. And I've been following a species called the northern white rhino for years now. And there are only five left.
Mm.
Five in the world. There's three in Kenya and two in zoos. One in San Diego, one in Europe. They have never successfully bred, or at least these living animals haven't.
Well, they're probably depressed. I mean, come on.
Well, you know, yeah, it's not exactly easy. That's why the last three are in Kenya. They moved a few over there thinking, maybe let's try to get them to breed under their natural sun instead of in zoos. And they've kind of gotten a little bit of breeding activity. But, yeah, it's tough. And, of course, I always go back to orangutans, too.
Oh, yeah.
You know, they're one of the species that got me involved in conservation. And it's one that people really can make a difference on. If you look at the products that you're buying,
palm oil,
food to palm oil, exactly. It's in everything. It's in food. It's in makeup. It's in cosmetics. You know, it's in soaps. And if people choose not to buy things with palm oil that can make a difference to the habitat in Sumatra and on Borneo, that impact, you know,
did you see
being cut down for palm oil, and that is the habitat
Did you see
orangutans and tigers and so many other creatures?
Years of Living Dangerously.
Yeah.
That episode with Harrison Ford where he like just becomes, I mean, I'm like bawling when he's playing with this orangutan and he's like crying. You know, I mean, it was just, I had no idea this was, and I'm kind of, you know, I just can't retain it all, I guess, but or maybe I blocked it out because it's horrifying. But he goes to bat. I mean, he just really gets indignant with these people. Like, you can't be doing this. You just can't do this. And I fell in love with Harrison Ford even more, even though he's crashing his Millennium Falcon into golf courses.
Yeah, not the smartest move on his part, but you can't hold that against him.
No. He's an adventure guy. But
that's the thing. We just need to keep putting things in front of people's heads. And yes, it's a difficult topic. Yeah, it can make you rage. It can make you cry. But the other thing to do is look beyond that at the work, the good work, the great work that people are doing to conserve these species,
yes,
to study them, to understand them. And these are the heroes. And if you embrace the heroes who are doing great work, it helps you to overcome that feeling of
right hopelessness,
that feeling of helplessness.
Yeah, I really like that idea, and I know that there are so many things we can do, and I'm pretty sure you're going to share some stuff with us on the blog so people can really easily find out more.
Absolutely. It all boils down to personal choices.
Yeah.
Everything you do has an impact.
Yeah. Well, John, I wish we didn't have to cut this particular segment short, but I know you will come back and we will talk
Absolutely.
About more of the, because there's so much to talk about. So thank you for your time, John, and your hard work on this. It's great stuff.
Well, thank you, Meg. I appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Green Divas Heart Wildlife. Please visit thegreendivas.com, that's T-H-E, greendivas.com, to learn more about wildlife, nature, and a whole lot more.
So, you know, I get a lot of things in my email box during this Earth Month, and I mean, I always do, but it takes a lot to get my attention. But this email got my attention. It's about the 2016 greenest states, and I thought, oh, let me just take a look at that, see where New Jersey lands, because that's where I live. And I was actually pretty astonished, first of all, with the top 10. And the lowest 10, and then there's a lot more information behind it, which I kind of dove into. And so I was really glad when Jill Gonzalez, who is an analyst with Wallet Hub, who did the study, agreed to give us a call and talk to us today. Hi, Jill.
Hi. Thanks for having me, Megan.
Well, seriously, I there are some pretty, to me, seemed a little bit shocking statistics. I don't know, call me crazy, but I was looking for California to be in the top 10 and was kind of shocked it isn't. Now I know it's a large state, but they're pretty conscientious.
They are, yeah. They came in at 12.
Okay.
And a lot of that has to do with things like consumption. I mean, the problem in California is that a lot of times there's a drought going on there. So their water consumption is actually sky high because they're using so much more of it through their tap and, you know,
okay,
for drinking, for swimming. They're not getting a lot of it naturally.
And then the study goes on. And now, first of all, New Jersey, I know people like to trash New Jersey, you know, but we were in the top 10, albeit number 10. I'm kind of impressed.
Yeah, exactly. New Jersey is up there in the top 10, probably some other states that people might not have thought would be up there, or New York, Connecticut too, a lot of northeastern states there. New Jersey really excelled when it comes to climate change contribution, so pretty low numbers in terms of greenhouse gas emissions, CO2 emissions, nitrous oxide, and things like that.
Well, that's comforting to know. It is a little surprising. I know that at one point in our history, we were among the top states in renewable energy, but I don't think we are as much anymore.
Correct. Not so much anymore, but not bad either. More like a middle of the pack.
All right.
So, yeah, I think a lot of times when people do trash talk New Jersey, and I'm actually from there as well. But yeah, I mean, not even when it comes to just solid waste, you know, types of trash and things like that, New Jersey still is not in the bottom 10. California actually is, just in terms of sheer municipal solid waste per capita too. So lots of surprising facts here.
So let's back up a little bit and just talk about what the study entails and what categories were taken into consideration and, you know, how the study was done so people understand what we're talking about.
Sure. So we compiled 17 relevant metrics here across three different categories. One, we talked about a little climate change contributions, CO2 emissions, greenhouse gas emissions, et cetera. We also looked into total environmental quality. So that has to do with municipal solid waste, air, water, soil quality, the energy efficiency score within each state also. And then finally, eco-friendly behaviors. Green buildings, you know, the number of LEED certified buildings mm-hmm. per capita, energy consumption from just sheer energy and electricity to gasoline and water, also transportation, how much green transportation is available and how many alternative fuel vehicles were out on the road as well.
Yeah, and I know California, because we've spent a lot of time in Southern California, and they don't have a lot of public transportation. It's very sprawling, so they do fail in the public transportation department.
Yeah, with bigger states like that, you run into that time after time. California yeah. does have some incentive programs that helps get a little more numbers of those alternative fueled vehicles on the road. So per 1,000 residents, they have about five. That ranks 16th in the country. New Jersey's more like 4. A place like New Mexico is actually at 11 or so per 1,000. So it's definitely possible to get into the double digits.
I noticed Maine was one of the top performers, at least with recycling in particular. Am I reading that right?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. So Maine overall ranked 6th best. But when it comes to those eco-friendly behaviors like recycling, that's why it is so far up there into the top 10. It also has a high percentage of energy consumption from renewable resources. So it is doing quite well there.
So tell us, what was the most surprising thing that struck you in the data you got gathered?
Well, when you're looking toward the bottom of the list, so the bottom five here are Nebraska, West Virginia, Montana, North Dakota, Wyoming. I think when people think of Montana or Wyoming, you know, you think of big green spaces
right.
or like a lot of snowfall, very beautiful in the winter. And unfortunately, because of that, because it is so sprawling and it oftentimes gets very cold, that is actually a huge energy suck. You know, when it comes to consumption, looking into energy efficiency, the energy and gasoline consumption there per capita, those numbers really do skyrocket for most months out of the year. So that is unfortunately what landed them so far down on the list. And I at least was surprised to see that.
And were there any, now you've probably done this study, I think, for a couple of years at least, right?
Yeah, we have for a couple of years. We haven't seen any drastic changes here. If anything, we've seen places like New Jersey, New York, New Hampshire, Connecticut move up a couple spots in the list. And that's because they're getting more LEED certified buildings. You know, a lot of these cities or kind of newer city suburbs are revamping. They're wanting millennials and businesses to move in. And with that, they have to be attractive for them. And that's why we are seeing so many LEED certified buildings there. So that, of course, increases their score. Again, if you go to a Montana, Wyoming, not a lot of buildings there are being updated. So that's, I think, another problem.
Yeah. Well, and I always think, like, if I'm in Montana and I've got to go to the grocery store, you know, it's not like a two-mile ride, probably. I mean, unless you're right in the town there. But so many folks live in these sprawled-out areas, and you have to run further to get anywhere, right?
Yeah, you're exactly right. So that right there is going to be more gas. Public transportation is almost non-existent in a lot of those sprawling states. So you're exactly right, more consumption and less public transportation options as well.
Now, I looked at one of the ways that you quantified the data. It was interesting in contrasting like the top five in a category and the bottom five and what the percentage gap was. Can you explain what I'm talking about?
Sure. So we looked at the top five and bottom five in some of these bigger categories. specifically ones like water quality, air quality, to see how big of a difference there is. So take energy consumption, for instance. We were just talking about some states that use it a lot more than others. The bottom of the list, Wyoming, Alaska, Louisiana, they're very cold or very hot places,
right,
depending on the time of year. So when you compare those states to those that use the lowest energy, Rhode Island, New York, California, there's actually 6 times a difference there just between energy consumption numbers alone.
Hmm.
When you're looking at one of these eco-friendly behaviors like recycling, Louisiana, number 50 here, 48 times less recycling going on in Louisiana than in Maine.
Come on, people. So some of that is just purely education, I suppose?
I would say so. I mean, half of it is education. The other half is implementation.
Right. Are there you know, the facilities there for that, the infrastructure for? Wow. So there's a lot to learn from this. I mean, short of shaming states, which we won't do, I guess it's hopeful that the states that are kind of lagging behind, especially in certain categories, maybe people can get active in those states and start making things happen. Like people in Louisiana, you've got to recycle.
Yeah, exactly. And this can be used on so many levels. Obviously, we never want to shame any states here. But as an individual resident, you know, you can look at this study and say, hey, something needs to be done, kind of go grassroots about it. Or as a city official or, you know, a local authority, then again, you can really have some impact here.
Well, thank you so much, Jill, for this work and for coming on and talking to us about it. And the study can be found at wallethub.com, correct?
That's correct.
But I do believe we are going to post this, the podcast here of our talk and your post. Oh, and Gracie says, hello, happy Earth Day. Anyway, that'll also be on thegreendivas.com. But check out wallethub.com because they have a lot of different interesting information, and this is one of them. Thank you so much, Jill.
Thank you. Happy Earth Day to you and Gracie.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of the Green Divas Radio Show. Listen to the latest Green Divas shows every day at 11 a.m. and 6 p.m. Eastern Time on GDGD Radio at GDGDRadio.com or get the GDGD Radio app for free, or access our huge catalog of podcasts on demand on your favorite podcast network, iHeartRadio, iTunes, Stitcher, Spreaker, SoundCloud, and of course, along with all kinds of great posts about living a deeper shade of green on thegreendivas.com. That's THEGreenDivas.com.